It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, the best-selling author of Reading Lolita in Tehran joins the show. She looks at American culture through the viewpoint of its fiction.
First, we continue our series of candidate forums, and we'll move now to the state Senate, where one race in particular is getting a lot of attention.
Mike Ellis has represented Wisconsin's 19th Senate District in the Fox River Valley since 1982, but he announced his retirement earlier this year and will not be seeking another term. That means an open seat, and many observers are expecting a close race, one that could determine which party ultimately takes control of the Senate.
We'll hear from both candidates seeking that open seat. Joining us first is Penny Bernard Schaber. She represents Wisconsin's 57th Assembly District. She's the Democratic candidate in the race for the 19th Senate District seat. She joins us now from our studio in Green Bay. Penny, welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Rob and Veronica. I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's start off with the basics. Why are you running for state Senate?
Well, I'm running for state Senate because I think it's time for us to get down to work and to start making Wisconsin a stronger state, and a state that has equal opportunity for everybody, and a state that has a very strong, solid public education system, and one that pays people more for the work they do because they deserve to be paid more and not be dependent on the government for basic parts of life.
Now, what do you bring to the table here that your opponent, Roger Roth, would not?
Well, I bring to the table 30 years of being a physical therapist, where I had to analyze problems and find the core of the problem and be able to create a solution to that problem. So I bring the ability to communicate to many different kinds of people, to solve problems in a very thoughtful, deliberate way. And as the third oldest of 11 children, I learned how to work as a team very young in life, and I brought that forward with me.
Now, no matter what race we're talking about, the overriding issue this election season seems to be jobs. What policies would you put forward in the Senate to try to bring jobs to your district and Wisconsin as a whole?
Well, I've been on the Jobs and Economy Committee for the last 6 years, and in that committee we work on tax incentives and we work on a variety of different kind of strategies for bringing jobs to Wisconsin. And I think we need to change our focus so that we look at small businesses and startup businesses and make sure that we're able to support them and not just focusing on stealing jobs from another state, but actually growing jobs right here in Wisconsin. And we can do that by encouraging our contractors to buy from Wisconsin manufacturers first rather than buying from out-of-state manufacturers. There's a number of things that we can do for that.
One big jobs issue that came up in the last session was the mining bill, oriented largely toward a proposed iron mine in northern Wisconsin. What is your feeling about what ended up passing there?
Well, I was on that committee, and I was very disappointed in the bill that passed, because the bill that passed, though people say it didn't change the standards for environmental levels and protection, it exempted the mine from those standards, so the mine does not have to live by the standards. And we have an economy in the mining counties around our country that is not very strong, and it's a boom and bust society or a boom and bust economic system in the mining counties, and I don't think we should repeat that here in Wisconsin. So I'd rather see us focus in on stronger jobs in the area, develop locally grown food, do organic gardening, organic farming, and working very hard on those kinds of things that are sustainable and not just looking at mining as the only way to solve the economic problems in northern Wisconsin.
Turning to the state budget, we've dealt with things like structural deficits on and off over the decades, really. It seems like we may be headed for another one coming up. What kind of changes would you propose to the budget to get Wisconsin's finances in order?
Well, I believe that we are heading towards a deficit right now, that Governor Walker's strategy is going to backfire on him, and we will actually end up with a deficit in our budget. And we have put forward some ideas about how to avoid that deficit. I think one of them would be to be taking the federal money for the expansion of Badger Care. That's tax dollars that we have paid to Washington, and we should get them back here in Wisconsin. That would help us. That would make sure that families are covered and able to access health care. That would also create jobs in the health care system. We've also closed a corporate tax loophole that has been reopened by the Walker administration, and I would say that we should reclose that corporate tax loophole and make sure that corporations who work here in Wisconsin, who provide jobs for people in Wisconsin, also are responsible for some of the expenses that our communities face.
Now, speaking of budgets, the state's transportation fund has been a bit of a head scratcher. Concerns for the future, declining revenue from gas tax. Are there changes you'd like to see made, raising the gas tax, toll roads that you'd like to see us pursue to maintain our roads into the future?
Well, I've been on the Transportation Committee, and I have worked for the last 6 years very hard to get what's called a Regional Transit Authority passed for the Fox Cities, and I believe that would help us to support with a sustainable local funding source to support our public transportation system. That is one of the recommendations from the commission that the governor put together. The other recommendations all require some deliberate study, and I believe we'll probably have to pick a combination of those. We might need to go back to indexing of the gas tax. We should be looking at a vehicle miles traveled option, and we should look at whether or not we will have to increase our gas tax. I don't know that we will, but we should at least look at it and study it and make a decision so that we have a good, sustainable, long-term funding for our transportation, including all other modes of transportation, not just road building.
Another hot topic lately is the minimum wage in Wisconsin and nationally for that matter. Would you support raising the minimum wage? And if so, what do you think would be an appropriate level?
People in Wisconsin work very, very hard, and they work hard to be independent and self-sufficient. And I believe that if we raise the minimum wage, we'll help them to do that. I think the minimum wage should be raised. I believe the 10-10 amount that has been talked about is a goal that we should have as our initial goal for raising the minimum wage. We probably should look at trying to set it up so it's not dependent on political decisions, maybe having a wage commission of some kind, or set it as an indexed wage increase tied to certain measurable outcomes that we see in the economy to see if we can raise the wage on a regular basis without making it a political football, because we really should put people first and politics second.
Speaking of political footballs, education, lots of controversies, lots of debates, fights over things like public education funding, expansion of charters and vouchers, Common Core curriculum. What is your vision? What's your priority when it comes to education in the state?
Well, I believe Wisconsin has a history of a very strong public education system all the way from kindergarten and all the way up through our technical colleges and our university system. And it should be one of our main priorities to make sure that we fully fund education from the beginning to the end. And that means that we have to look at our funding formula and try to find a way to make that formula more fair to all the school districts in Wisconsin. When the Wisconsin schools were capped, In the late 90s, some schools were capped at a very low spending rate, and some schools were capped at a higher spending rate, and that sets up inequality within the formula that we have. We need to look more carefully at that formula and make sure that we help the schools to be able to serve the kids the best that they possibly can.
Is there a particular issue in your region there that the rest of the state might not have on the radar that you think should be tackled at the state legislative level?
Well, we do have the Fox River, which has been a polluted river over the last number of years. It's finally getting cleaned up, and I'm happy to say that I was a very important part of that, getting it cleaned up, and it's going along very well. So redevelopment of our downtowns and redevelopment along the river in an environmentally sustainable fashion would be really good, and it would be a great way to rebuild the economy in our Fox cities and make sure that people are able to stay around in their own hometowns or in their own neighborhoods and work hard, play hard, and get educated well.
Words like divisiveness and polarization come up a lot when we talk about Wisconsin's legislature. Are there ways you think you could, if elected to the Senate, find common ground with your Republican peers?
Well, I've always tried to do that. When I first got into office, I was able to pass the electronic waste recycling bill, and I did that because I worked with a Republican legislator from the Milwaukee area to address the concerns that he had heard from business. And so rather than ignoring his concerns, I worked with him and got the concerns addressed. I've also done that with the Regional Transit Authority bill that I put together. And I worked with Senator Ellis, actually, to make sure that the bill was the appropriate bill that could hopefully get passed in the state Senate. And he got it passed in the Senate. I unfortunately had people standing in my way and could not get it passed in the state assembly. I'm hopeful that as we move forward, we'll get that bill passed this next session.
As we wrap up, 2 weeks till Election Day, early voting going on now, your final words for voters?
Well, I encourage people to look carefully at the candidates themselves, to ignore the special interest groups that have a tremendous amount of power in this race, because they're trying to buy the election. They're trying to put messages out about people that basically are not accurate and true. And so the voters should actually pay attention to the candidates, check out their websites, watch them carefully, call them up and talk to them if they want to, but pay attention to the candidates versus the special interest groups that are out there trying to buy the race.
Penny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Penny Bernard-Shaber. She's the Democratic candidate in the race for the 19th Senate district seat. Right now, we continue our conversations with the candidates running to represent Wisconsin's 19th Senate district, viewed as a key to control of the state Senate. We just heard from the Democrat in that race, Penny Bernard-Shaber. Now we turn to her opponent, Roger Roth. He's a small business owner and former state assembly representative. He's the Republican candidate running for the seat. He joins us from our studio in Green Bay. Roger, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, start off with the basics again. Why are you running for state Senate?
Well, I'm running for the state Senate because I don't believe we can turn back to the time when Madison was an enemy of job creation. And if you look at my background, I'm a third-generation home builder, been building houses here in northeast Wisconsin my entire life. I know what it's like to pass a budget. I know what it's like to balance a budget. I know what it's like to work with local units of government, permitting processes, and so forth. And I want to take that experience down to Madison. Also, an 11-year member of the Wisconsin International Guard, served several tours in the Middle East, a few to Iraq. And I learned a lot about leadership there. I want to take those experiences down to Madison because if ever there's a place where we need to build consensus, work together, corral people on a common objective, I think it's there. And as you alluded to, I was a member of the State Assembly for two terms in the middle of the last decade, and looking to take that experience as well as getting things done to Madison. I think those experiences uniquely qualify for me for this race, and looking forward to listening to the good folks of the 19th Senate District and getting down to Madison and advocating on their behalf.
And what do you bring to the table in particular that your opponent, Penny Bernard-Shaber, doesn't?
Well, I think I touched on a few of them. You know, small business owner, third generation. My grandfather started our construction company in 1952, and my brother and myself run that now. And I think it's a good experience to have. Out of 132 legislators in Madison, we don't have one that's a home builder. So I think having a home builder, that will be important. I think military service is very important, too. I think you learn a lot about leadership, a lot about service when you serve in the military, and I think that separates me as well.
You mentioned job creation. That's been the hot topic pretty much in all our races here in the state. What particular policies would you want to advance in the Senate to bring jobs to your part of the state and the state as a whole?
Yeah, well, job creation is the number one issue I hear about out on the campaign trail, and there's a few things I think we can do. First and foremost, we have to make sure that Wisconsin is competitive and open for business. And we see that some reforms were passed over the last few years. We see now our unemployment rate at the lowest level since before the recession, 5.5%. So we're moving in the right direction. Just a lot of people I talk to say we got to go a little bit quicker, and that's what I intend to do. Making sure that we have a good tax climate here in Wisconsin that makes us competitive to our neighboring states and around the country is a very important thing. I will certainly work towards that. As a small business owner, I know the process you have to go through, paperwork and so forth, to hire a person. I'd like to see what we can do to streamline and simplify that process. I really do believe that if we give small business owners a little more simplification and make that process easier, it'll be easier for them to go and hire people in the first place. And also, Governor Walker and the legislature, the course of the last 4 years, put $130 million, over $130 million actually, into worker retraining program. That's very key because in this economy, when you lose a job, we've got to make sure that we're there through our technical college system to make sure that people are able to go out and get the skills necessary to get a job in today's changing workforce.
Before we move on from jobs, one of the big issues, the most hotly contested votes in the Senate in the last couple of years was the mining regulations vote, in part to free up an iron mine in the northern part of the state. What was your take on what came out of that?
Well, I wasn't in the legislature when they passed that, but I would have supported it because this is putting people to work. And I think if you go to Iron County, you go to northern Wisconsin, talk to these folks, they want this mine, and for good reason. You know, the construction of this mine will bring over 6,200 temporary jobs during the construction phase and 700 permanent jobs that pay $83,000 a year salary and benefits. So you talk to those folks that they want it. These are the kind of things that I think we can do in Madison, because as much as I'll say it, when Republicans and Democrats say, hey, I'm going to create X amount of jobs, you know, as someone who knows what it takes to create a job, government doesn't create jobs. The only thing they can do is to create that atmosphere. And part of the thing they did with this mining bill was they helped create an atmosphere by which mining companies can come in, have some, with a permitting process, have some certainty there. They still have to follow the same regulations with a EPA and with the DNR and with the Army Corps of Engineers, but they have a little more certainty going forward. So I support that. I support the jobs up there. And if anyone talks to folks from northern Wisconsin, you'll find that they overwhelmingly support this as well.
Moving on to the state budget, we've had things like structural deficits on and off over the last couple decades. Some predictions of a shortfall coming up next year. What changes would you like to see in the budget to make sure Wisconsin's finances stay in order?
Well, first on those, what you touched about the possible deficit, that was figuring that 1.8 deficit that they're talking about, $1 billion, assumes that there's no growth in revenue. We have never had a time in the history of our state where we've had 0% growth in our economy. Certainly, we've had growth that was better than others. So it's important, I think, to note that going first place. But when it comes to budgeting, I think passing a budget without a structural deficit is sound fiscal policy. And I would certainly advocate and support that within our caucus and within the legislature to make sure that we're making the tough calls of paying for our bills right on time and right up front.
The transportation budget in particular worries about the future of how we pay for road building and road maintenance as revenue from gas tax declines. Would you like to see new changes made, maybe raising the gas tax, tolls, to keep the roads good in the future?
Well, the most important thing that I tell folks regarding transportation is that we've got to vote yes on the segregated transportation amendment, which is on everyone's ballot who's listening to us now in the state of Wisconsin. It's on your ballot this November 4th. I say we've got to vote yes on that because in the past, Republican and Democrat, but in the past, governors have raided that transportation fund. Governor Doyle, $1.3 billion over 8 years. So there's no sense sitting down and having the tough conversation of how we're going to add revenues to that fund if we're going to allow politicians just to raid that fund on the back end. So first and foremost, let's make that segregated. That's something I can't do, though. That's something that the voters of the state are going to have to work on. And if that's passed, then I'm an all options on the table guy. I think we've got to go down there, roll up our sleeves. If we're honest about it, none of those options look pretty to put revenue streams back into the fund. But I don't think it behooves any of us to take any of those off the table at this time.
There's been talk about Wisconsin's minimum wage lately, $7.25. Some calls saying it's too low, needs to go up. Some say it would be bad for jobs. What's your take on the minimum wage?
It most certainly would be bad for jobs. Raising the minimum wage, it's hurting the very people we're trying to help. And there was a report by the Bureau of Labor Statistics in 2012. It showed that there were 92,000 people in Wisconsin earning minimum wage. Now, that number, it's probably changed somewhat since then, but 92,000 people earning minimum wage. And several reports have come out saying that raising the minimum wage would cost 27,000, up to 27,000 jobs. So to me, it doesn't make sense to give 65,000 people a raise and then fire 27,000 people. Going back to what I said before, Wisconsin's got to be, you know, Madison can no longer be the enemy of job creation. We've got to go out there and create that atmosphere. And you do that by doing things like the mining bill, which brings 700 high-paying permanent jobs. Those aren't minimum wage jobs. Those are family-supporting jobs, which can really boost that part of our state and I think would be good for our overall economy.
A lot of controversy about education in recent years, public education funding, charter and voucher schools, Common Core. What's your vision for the future of Wisconsin education?
Well, you listed a lot of things there. Let me see if I can talk about all of those in order. With school vouchers, I support school vouchers, but I think they have to be targeted. You know, when it comes to education in our state, we want to make sure, our goal as a legislature ought to make sure that kids are receiving a first-rate education to prepare them not only to succeed in our state, in our country, but in our entire world. And that's got to be our number one goal. So if we go to areas with failing school districts, I think vouchers provide those children with direct access right now, a ticket out to a good education. Because the only thing that's going to separate them from success and failure is that good education. So I support that. But at the same hand, I don't want to create a competing school district. We want to have strong and vibrant public schools, and I think charter schools offer a great opportunity in our state because times have changed. I think we understand now more about educating children and how they learn than we ever have, and I think charter schools provide that opportunity where you can reach kids where they're at, kind of fit and mold their learning style to what best fits them.
And Roger, I asked you a big question. We're running short on time. Briefly, a few last words for voters 2 weeks from Election Day.
Well, this is a big election. It couldn't be more important in the Fox Valley area. I really think that we're going to decide what happens in statewide races and, of course, in this race as well. So I'd encourage folks to go out there. I would certainly ask for their consideration. They can check out our website and contact me if they have further questions. But most importantly, get out there and vote.
Roger, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Roger Roth. He's the Republican candidate running for the open seat in Wisconsin's key 19th Senate district. When she was growing up in Iran, best-selling author Azar Nafisi first discovered American literature through books like Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and Babbitt by Sinclair Lewis. These books riveted her childhood imagination and shaped her early impressions of the United States.
When she later moved to the United States, Nafisi was surprised to find a disconnect between the vision of America she found in its literature and the country she encountered upon arrival. She wondered why the country's politics seemed at odds with the values of its art, music, and literature, and how a country with such cultural wealth could harbor so many lonely people.
In her new book, The Republic of Imagination, she makes the case for solving some of America's biggest problems, including education, rising school violence, and the crisis in the humanities by looking at it through the lens of literature.
Azar Nafisi is with us now. She is the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, which sold over 1.5 million copies and was translated into 32 languages. She's also a fellow at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Her new book is called Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. Azar, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
In part, this book came about because you were haunted by a young Iranian man who came to your book signing. You call him Ramin, and what he said to you then. Can you tell us that story?
It was during one of my book signings at Elliott Bay Bookstore in Seattle, Washington, and I see this young man sit, looking very somber. And when his turn came, he didn't have a book. He told me that he had just recently come to the United States, and then in a very sort of heartbreaking language, actually, tone, he told me that you're wasting your time. These people don't care about books and things like that. They're not like us, Xeroxing hundreds of pages of Madame Bovary or Mark Twain. And that sort of set me thinking that what Ramin said, how true that was, and can a democracy survive without a democratic imagination?
Now, ever since that day, as you said, you've been thinking about what he said, and you've been building the case that the imagination matters to democracy and the imaginative works of fiction that you read and you grew up on. Why do you think that even in democratic societies, we need to care deeply about the spaces that imaginative worlds of fiction open up?
Well, I think that, certain things are universal. They're like bread and water. Just being human, we need it. And I think the telling of the story, imagining life as it could be or as it should be, and empathy, imagining ourselves in places of others, and being curious and wanting to find out about other people through imagination is in our human makeup. But, with America specifically, when I was a very young kid, I got to know America like all the other countries through this imaginary map. And I remember that when I read The Wizard of Oz, and I thought that, oh my God, in the middle of this desert, there is this fertile land of Oz where Dorothy goes and comes back with, a new experience. And then I was watching American films, which seemed very strange to me at the time when you're talking to someone and then in the middle of your talk, you start singing and dancing. So America, for me, was a land of imagination. And when I read its history, the fact that the founding fathers had created this country partly because the country needs bridges and engineers and people getting good jobs and living, and also just as important on spiritual and intellectual nourishment and their focus on being carrying on the legacy on enlightenment. Humanities was very important in the creation of this country, and humanity are still important in the development and preservation of this country.
And yet you list bookstore after bookstore that has closed in America in recent years. You talk about arts programs that are cut, arts teachers that are lost, school curriculum, you say, that steers children away from asking questions and using imagination. What do you think is happening?
Well, that was what set me, more and more made me think that I want to write this book, because especially in the system of education and with our public schools, where because of funding or whatever, nowadays poetry and art and music are not as essential to children's education, but as luxuries that many public schools can no more afford. And I thought that what is happening is that there is a trend, which I talk about in the second chapter when I'm talking about Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt, which is very utilitarian and short-sighted and also looks at the world just through the eyes of material success and money and more money. And I think that is a trend that you see at least our elite. And that is a trend that is becoming very dominant in our education, where rather than providing the means for realize their talents, their natural inclinations, their passion, we are just using schools as career-ready institutions. And that is not how a democracy acts or survives.
Now, you look at American society and culture and the state of its democracy through this lens of fiction, and one of the three books that you focus on, the first of them, is Huckleberry Finn, and you read this during the rise of the Islamic Republic in Iran. How has its the characters and the conflicts there informed your view of the world?
At the very first I properly read it, I had heard the story from my father, but I read it in college, and then I taught, it was the first book I taught at the Islamic Republic of Iran. At that time, me and my students, living under the conditions that we were living, we were sort of focusing on this whole idea of the repressive kind of society that, in fact, Huck and Jim lived in, and the heroism of both of them was the fact that they rejected, at the risk of losing their lives, among other things, the sort of conformity and the sort of image that the conformist society, the Sunday school society, wanted to impose on them. And I was telling my students that Huck, for me, represents an independent mind, and when I came to United States, I realized that as opposed to the kind of individualism right now that constantly preaches selfishness and each one of us for our own, we need to have Huck Finn's kind of individualism, which means independence of thought, but is always growing and it's always creating a moral ground for itself through connecting to others and through giving to others, because of the relationship between Huck and Jim, which is essentially a give-and-take relationship. And Huck learns through his relationship with Jim how to become a better person, a more moral person.
And do you think that kind of individualism is what the forefathers would have hoped for from its citizenry?
I do think so. You know, when you have, and I talk about it in my book, in Huck chapter, especially because I was talking and discussing it constantly with a friend of mine who is also Persian. You know, we were talking about the fact that this is a very poetic country, in essence. When you have the Declaration of Independence that talks about pursuit of happiness, and it wants life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness for every individual, as their right, that country cannot live in ignorance. That country cannot live without imaginative knowledge. That country cannot segregate the passion for science from the passion for humanities. And that is what Jefferson was talking about. He said that we need to build bridges. We need to have houses. But side by side with that, we need to have knowledge. And they were well-versed in Cicero and Tacitus, the Roman and Greek philosophers and thinkers. And Washington, father of this country, talks about the fact that the happiness of a society relies on teaching literature, on education based on literature and science. So how could we say that we are carrying on their legacy without carrying on the spirit of that legacy?
Azar, what do you think that we lose when we stop putting a premium on the world of imagination and the things that it produces, the poetry and the fiction and the music?
I think that, you know, there is a quotation I used actually in reading Lolita from Saul Bellow when he was talking about the fact that a country who loses its passion for poetry and for its soul is a country that faces death. No country, and especially this country, wants its children and the world to know about it only through its military and political might. What represents America is its history, both the good and the bad, but its resilience and the fact that it has constantly looked at itself critically and has tried to change. We see this best in the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement and the minorities rights movement. These all come out of our imagination, our restlessness, our desire to change and the desire for change and for an innovation would not exist without the ability to imagine and without the space to put your imagination to work. You know, our young people today are using Apple all the time, and they should read Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs and Einstein and find out that how these two men believed in the power of imagination even more than science.
Azar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Azar Nafisi, best-selling author of Reading Lolita in Tehran. Her new book is called The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books.
Winter is about a month away here in Wisconsin. As the seasons change, concerns for road safety also arise. As driving conditions worsen, defensive driving can be the key to saving lives. That's especially true for young people because auto crashes are the number one killer of teens in the country.
The Wisconsin public health nonprofit Safe Communities offers a defensive driving course called Alive at 25, working with local governments. It's geared towards young people, but the lessons apply to anyone looking to improve road safety. Here with us to give a brief course in defensive driving are Kathy Hansen and Randy Weisinger. Kathy is the Alive at 25 instructor and retired police chief from the Lake Mills Police Department. Randy is a Dane County Sheriff's deputy. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Randy, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Well, Randy, as we head into winter, what safety concerns arise?
Well, we get kind of complacent throughout the summer months, spring, summer, and fall, when the road conditions are generally good, and we get very distracted. We are multitasking a lot, regardless of the age, whether it's new drivers or anybody for that matter. And so that becomes a pretty big concern as we enter into a season where the road conditions can be unpredictable.
And Kathy, Alive at 25 is geared toward teen drivers who have this higher accident and death rate, but do the lessons apply to anyone here?
Yeah, the lessons apply to anyone, but the Alive at 25 focuses on the age group of 16 to 25.
And what are some of the takeaways that we should be thinking about?
For the class, we're teaching them, you know, responsibility, that they're responsible for their actions, the control, you know, they have control over their vehicle, what happens in the vehicle. We deal with the distractions, you know, don't be distracted because you never know what's going to happen in that other car.
Randy, what are some of the main driving hazards to be aware of on the road in any season?
Well, a lot of times people are, you know, afraid that they can't really control the actions of other drivers around them. But in reality, we're in control of our vehicle and our safety margin around us, whether that means increasing the following distance, decreasing your speed. During periods of weather that unpredictable road conditions, it allows you more time to react, and then, of course, not being distracted and doing anything else.
So is a big part of this, Kathy, as you're driving your vehicle, to try to really take in what's around you.
Yes, driving really is, it's multitasking because, you know, you're driving your vehicle, but you're also, you're watching everything that's going on around you. You're watching the other vehicles, you know, for anything to happen. So I think I answered it.
And, Kathy, what are the pillars of defensive driving?
What are the pillars? I don't know.
What about you, Randy?
Well, again, being in control of your actions, monitoring your speed, being able to look far enough in front of your vehicle so you can react properly. And a lot of people, you know, think that maybe 2 to 4 seconds in front of their vehicle is a long ways to be looking. In defensive driving, we talk 4 seconds is an absolute minimum that you should be scanning, and not just in front of you, but around you, including behind you.
Now, a lot of us think of traffic accidents as the ultimate and sort of a lightning bolt out of the blue, the thing you don't really have any control over. Are we right in thinking about it that way?
Well, traffic, we don't call them accidents, and we don't call them accidents for a reason. They're called traffic crashes. If we use the word accident, that means that it happened by accident. And in fact, traffic crashes happen because there is a driver error. Almost every single crash happens because somebody made a mistake. It could be the other driver. But if you drive defensively and keep, you know, your surroundings visible to you, you can often avoid that crash. But it's not an accident.
So how do you prepare for that moment, that large traffic that might be around you? Or what did you call it instead of an accident?
Crash. It's
a crash. Or a crash. How do you prepare for that?
Well, again, for like Live at 25, we recommend that people take classes like that. You know, driver training when you're 16 or 15 and a half is the bare minimum because that's what's required by the law to get your license. But that's not where it should stop. There's a lot more classes out there, driver education opportunities out there to improve your driving habits, including your mental capacity of driving down the road.
And Kathy, there's a lot of gadgetry in cars these days. You know, the radio has been around for a long time, but there'll also be people sitting next to you. Presumably they may want to talk to you. There are cell phones in the car. What advice do you have for navigating some of the in-car distractions, especially, I suppose, cell phones?
Well, at the Live at 25, what I emphasize is, you know, they have control of the vehicle, they have control of the people in the vehicle, and they should make rules. You know, you don't answer your phone. You designate you're the one that can touch the radio so that, you know, people aren't distracting them. And I emphasize, you know, you're responsible. You know, parents are expecting you to get, you know, their child to wherever you're going and back safely. So you need to focus on your driving. And we do a lot of scenarios to get them thinking about different things that could happen on the road.
And what's an example of something that you could sort of workshop, maybe if you're a parent with a teenager, and play it out ahead of time?
Oh, it's, you know, and the kids do like joyriding. They'll use that. Somebody asked me to do this, or somebody will ask me to, let's see how fast your car can go. And I was like, you need to think about it. You know, and I tell them, look at the positives and the negatives. What, you know, if you did it, what positive things would come out of there? Is there any positives? And then what are the negatives and what are the consequences? And try to get them to think of that. What if I do this, what could happen? What, you know, go either way.
And so, Randy, have you seen this work, this kind of thing, playing out some of these scenarios ahead of time?
Well, I think it does. And I think that over the years, we have we've certainly gone a long ways in educating our youth as to the hazards of drinking and driving, and the fact that even as they become of legal drinking age, it's not uncommon for us in law enforcement to stop a vehicle in which the driver is sober and the occupants are drinking. And that's a good thing that we didn't see many years ago. You know, to follow up on what parents can do, really would help a lot if parents would consider driving a privilege and not a right. Because that's what we try to teach young people. To have a driver's license is a privilege. It's not a right. As a parent myself, I know that it becomes extremely convenient when my kids get old enough that they can drive themselves to and from places. But if they abuse that privilege, it will be taken away.
Something they have to earn.
That's correct.
Do you think most parents think of it that way, or do you think most parents, you know, it's a rite of passage in America. Your kid turns 16, they pass a course, you know, you give them their wheels.
Well, I'm not sure. Based on driving records that I see of the people that I have contact with, the number of times they've either been in crashes or received citations, and the fact that their parents are still paying for a car for them, I'm not sure that the parents get it.
I don't think parents realize that they can pull a driver's license. They can pull it from them.
I suppose the kids don't like that, but it does send a message.
It does send a message, yeah.
For sure. Now, in terms of aggressive drivers, that's something that everybody encounters on the road at one time or the other, no matter where you are. What advice do both of you have for dealing with aggression on the road? Randy, we'll start with you.
Well, I guess it depends on which side of that aggression you're on. You know, I look for and deal with the people that are the aggressive drivers themselves. And it's not always that the person is aggressive. It's that usually they're late. Usually they're doing more than one thing. They have way too many things on their plate and on their schedule, and they just simply don't have time for this thing that we call traffic safety or traffic laws. And that's what leads to what we visualize in the public as aggressive driving.
And Kathy?
You need patience. I mean, because we are a fast-paced world, and I really emphasize patience. Sometimes, you know, say no, that you can't keep doing everything. You can't keep running like that. The other thing, I mean, sometimes, you know, just go at a slower pace and get so your adrenaline slows down.
And that is just part of it, right? You get someone who's on your tail. Maybe you've got children in the car. You may get angry yourself in response. What advice do you have for people about keeping their cool when they're on the road, Randy?
Well, you know, to build off of that, if you allow enough time in your schedule so that you don't, number one, don't have to necessarily drive the speed limit to get there because you only have one extra minute, you can actually make a turn, turn off that road, turn around, get back on that road, and that aggressive driver that was behind you is now gone. And that's something very proactively that you can do. It's very easy to do, and then it takes you out of that situation. Unfortunately, the majority of us don't allow that kind of time in our schedule, so we don't have that ability to turn off the road and wait for that aggressive driver to leave. So we feel compelled to stay in front of them, and then we become part of the problem.
And should you call the police if you see someone driving like that? Should police respond and, I don't know, like to hear about unsafe drivers?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, there's not enough of us, and we're not usually in the right place at the right time, but sometimes we are. And so, absolutely, if they witness something like that, they should call 911, report as much information, but they still need to take care of their safety. And if that means detouring off that route and getting rid of that driver so that they go a different direction, that's what they should do.
Great. Well, thank you both for joining us. Randy, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Kathy, thank you to you as well.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Kathy Hansen, a Live at 25 instructor and retired police chief from the Lake Mills Police Department, and Randy Weisinger, Dane County Sheriff's Deputy.